add my welcome to Tom's. It's really nice to see you here. Thank you for joining us at our carol service. If we haven't met before, my name is Chris Fishlock, and I'm part of the leadership team here. And I know we've got a number of visitors with us as well. Particular welcome to you. As people who know me will know, I absolutely love Christmas, love every aspect of Christmas, and I'm always on the lookout for good Christmas jokes. Bear that in mind as you hear this one. Now, just before Christmas, so the story goes, three men get into a lift at the Ritz Hotel. An honest politician, an accountant with a sense of humor, and Father Christmas. As they travel from the fifth floor down to ground level, one by one, they notice a 50-pound note on the floor. The question is, which one picks up the 50-pound note, hands it into reception? Is it the honest politician? Is it the accountant with a sense of humor? Is it Father Christmas? Well, it's Father Christmas, obviously, because the others don't exist. Now, I apologized already to some of the lawyers that we have with us, because I really feel it should have been at the lawyer's expense. So again, apologies to not focus in on them. Anyway, look, just for a few minutes, I want to spend some time thinking about the Christmas story afresh. And you'll see it printed on the last page of the server sheet, reading that Connor read out for us just a few moments ago. Come back with me in time. About 2,000 years to Nazareth. Bit of a backwater 2,000 years ago. Actually, it remains so today, so I hear. In the region of Galilee, northern Israel, it's the sort of town that would never make it to anybody's bucket list. Okay, it's that sort of place. Population back in these days, 2,000 years ago, about 300. One large public bath, and people are just doing jobs like farming and tradesmen, that sort of thing. Two characters of interest, though, Mary and Joseph. Unknown and unremarkable like their surroundings. They're betrothed. We heard that detail in the reading. Carries the same legal weight in those days as marriage. And Mary is pregnant, important detail, to the point where I think we can probably conclude the emergency sort of hospital grab bag would have been at hand any moment now. And then the morning's news comes in. Have a look at the reading there on the service sheet. Now, my source for all the important details of the Christmas story come from the Bible. Particularly, we're going to be drawing on Luke's account, Luke's biography. And one of the things I'm going to encourage you to do on the back of today is to take away a copy of Luke's biography. We've got a stack of them at the back, and you could grab one on the way out. It's just a very helpful summary of Jesus' birth, life, death, resurrection. And as a minister in the city, I often find that people haven't actually considered that as an adult. So maybe you'd like to consider that. Anyway, let's just look at those few verses again, starting at verse 1. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration when Quirinius was governor of Syria. Now, Caesar Augustus, he's quite a character, sometimes known as Octavian, as we remember him. He'd been in power at this stage for about 20 years. Okay, so he's well established, often called the first emperor of Rome. And at this stage, he controlled over 3.5 million square miles of territory. It's a lot of land. Right up from the sort of the Rhine and the Danube in the north, stretching down as far as North Africa in the south, and then off on the west, Spain, France, sort of Gaul as it was known then, and in the east, Israel and beyond. Huge bit of territory. About 70 million people would have had coins with Octavian's head on them, spread out throughout the empire. No one doubted. I mean, if he was calling for a census, he would get one. A census enabled an emperor to be responsible and take stock of his empire. It facilitated good governance. And it made sure everybody paid tax. It was very useful. Now, back in Nazareth, as the morning news comes in, the idea of a census posed no particular threat to Mary and Joseph, our unknown characters. But all that changes when the next detail comes in. Just look at verse 3 in the text. All went to be registered, each to his own town. Now, that changes things. Now, just imagine for a moment, Mary. She turns to Joseph at this stage and says, own town? Joseph, own town, just remind me, where is it you're from again? a little bit sort of sheepish. Bethlehem. Bethlehem, says Mary. Bethlehem, that's 90 miles away. What on earth? How are we going to get to Bethlehem? I mean, your donkey, Joseph, have you been on it recently? 90 miles. I mean, even if we set out now, it's going to take a couple of weeks, and that's when the baby is due. I don't think anyone would ever choose a 90-mile donkey ride, especially if you're pregnant. But you see, Caesar's decree demanded a response. Joseph and his pregnant betrothed make their way to Bethlehem. Let's see how the story continues. Look at verse 4. Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed, who was with child. And while they were there, the time came for her to give birth, and she gave birth to her firstborn son. So let's just sort of stand back from this a little bit and ask, well, what do we know about Luke? As was introduced to us, we were told that he was a medical doctor. And it's interesting, his style of writing does stand in contrast a little bit to the other gospel writers. He's very precise, polished. And he tells us in his introduction that this biography of Jesus was written after very careful investigation. He doesn't waste words. He chooses everything carefully. And look at the interesting details he's put into the Christmas story. He started with a decree from the Roman emperor, literally a dogma, and then a journey from Nazareth to Bethlehem, and then just a little throwaway fact, Jesus born. Okay, that's not really how we normally sort of think about the Christmas story, I don't think. So why? I think a good question to ask, why does Luke give us these details, carefully selected? Well, straight away, I hope it's really obvious what he's not doing. He's not sort of setting up a sentimental response. Oh, let's all coo over the little baby who's in a manger with a little nativity scene all sort of carefully sanitized in the background. That's clearly not what he's doing. Instead, I'd like to suggest Luke's agenda. He wants us as readers, as we analyze his account, he wants us to understand what it was that led Joseph and Mary to travel from Nazareth to Bethlehem and make this journey that nobody would choose. That's an important detail to establish. Well, if you remember the reading we had just a few before, our main reading, from the first bit of Luke's Gospel, Ruth gave us the account of how Mary was meeting the angel Gabriel, and Mary was told, even though she was a virgin, that she would become pregnant by the Holy Spirit. And that the baby that was to be born was going to be the Son of God. That's quite a big thing to be told, isn't it? The Messiah. Now, everybody knew that the Messiah had to be born in Bethlehem. In fact, we even got it very explicit in that reading that we had from Andrew Crabtree on the prophet Micah. We were told, prophet Micah, 700 years before Jesus was born, the prophet Micah said he's got to be born in Bethlehem. Every Jewish family knew. You can't have a Messiah born in Nazareth. It would cut against the prophecies that have been clearly laid down. And it would also make a complete hash of our opening song, wouldn't it? I mean, just look at the words of our opening song. Once in royal David's city. I mean, imagine, we'd have to sort of change it to once in boring Nazareth, which wouldn't work at all. The Son of God, the Messiah, had to be born in Bethlehem. But Mary, who's pregnant with the Messiah, is in Nazareth. How do you get a pregnant woman from Nazareth to Bethlehem? God's solution, I'll get the Roman emperor to organize a census. That'll do it. And that brings me to the first of two points. God controls the might of Rome. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. From Augustus's point of view, he was just being a responsible administrator. There is no apparent interference of a divine nature in anything that he does. He's making a sensible administrative decision. And many people in history would hold him up as being an excellent emperor. And yet he's doing exactly what God had spoken through the prophet 700 years before. Little did he know that his census was giving legitimacy to the claim that Jesus really was the Messiah. Caesar was counting people. God is counting down prophecy. This is the Christian God, controlling the might of Rome, here to make sure that his son arrives in the designated place. And so what Luke is doing, our precise doctor who's writing this account, he wants us to see a contrast between, of course, the Roman Emperor, Augustus, and the relatively unknown until now baby Jesus. An interesting contrast to make. Let's just sort of consider, what did each achieve? What did each achieve? Well, Caesar Augustus, famous for bringing peace. You remember GCSE history? He brought the Pax Romana. In fact, it was even called the Pax Augusta to give him his due. 200 years of relative peace throughout the empire. And it was pretty good. Soft borders, easy travel. Romans loved building roads everywhere. There were roads everywhere. And of course, those roads started then to facilitate the spread of information. Exactly what enabled the Gospels, the biographies of Jesus, to go out. So Augustus gives the world Pax Romana, 200 years of relative peace, but it doesn't last. It never does. The peace deals in our world never last between people. What about Jesus? What's his greatest achievement? Well, I'd like to suggest it's also one of peace, but a very different type of peace. Not between different groups of people. Instead, between people, or perhaps I should say any individual person, and God. And Jesus secured that peace deal. That was the reason he came. And he did it by giving his life. You see, he died as a substitute for me, for anyone actually who wants to, is prepared to accept the offer of peace with God. A secure, a safe, a certain standing with the God who made each one of us. We're going to be singing about it in the last carol. Just glance down to the last carol. It's an absolute cracker. We're going to be there in a few minutes. Hark the herald angels sing. Just look, though, how it carries on in that first verse. Peace on earth and mercy mild. Peace on earth. What's the peace on earth? Well, it's explained in the next line, God and sinners reconciled. You see, earthly peace between peoples, it never lasts. God and humanity, there's a peace deal on offer, which is permanent and safe and secure. But isn't it just amazing, just to sort of consider where we are in this account of the Christmas story, how the might of Rome accommodates seamlessly the true and eternal King of Peace. So there we go, the first of 2 points. God controls the might of Rome. But even though God controls the might of Rome, isn't it interesting that God chooses the humility of the manger? Just glance at the last verse of the Christmas story one last time. She gave birth to her firstborn son, wrapped him in swaddling cloths, laid him in a manger, because there was no place for them at the inn. We see the humble origin in three details: the swaddling cloths, the manger, the lack of room in the inn. The swaddling cloths. Swaddling cloths, they were just sort of strips of linen that the baby would have been wrapped very carefully in, would have given some warmth and protection. Not exactly royal clothing, though, little sort of strips of makeshift cloth. As I said, Luke is a very precise writer, and later on, as Jesus' dead body on the cross is taken down, it's again wrapped in strips of cloth, laid not in a manger, but in a tomb. Luke wants us to see, and certainly it stands out after you've read the account a few times, his humble birth prefigures his humiliating death. The manger also, though, it's a feeding trough for animals. It's where we get the idea of a nativity scene. Jesus almost certainly shared those first few days with the livestock. And then no place at the inn. You see, God decided that no strings would be pulled and no favors called in and no inner circle appealed to. God chooses to send his son, his king, his Messiah, to the most humble surroundings, the most surprising surroundings, with all the might of Rome at his fingertips. Here his son arrives. Why? Well, crucially, This shows us what the sort of God he really is. Here is Jesus laying to one side his majesty, his glory. He holds that back. Not his deity. He's very much God on earth. But here he is. I mean, Jesus Christ, as you meet him, he is approachable. He walks the dusty roads. He cares for everyone he meets. He gives time to people you wouldn't expect. He worked as a carpenter. He debated theological issues. His opponents would use the toughest arguments, and Jesus always ran rings around them. His public ministry lasted just 3 short years, enough time to make it very clear that he really was God in the flesh. Supernatural acts carefully documented. And then, crucially, he took up the crown that he was destined to take up. Not a gold crown, but a crown of thorns. And not for anything he did, as I've already suggested. That was the heart of brokering the peace deal. I mean, he was mocked, he was tortured, and he was killed in the end. But of course, it was his death as a substitute, which incredibly made it possible for us to have peace. Again, that line, God and sinners reconciled. That's what we're about to sing. A sinner, somebody who pushes God out of their life. We're all the same, and it's our natural starting point. Some do it very rudely, some do it very politely. No time for God, a sinner. That is not a peaceful state to be in. And we're not talking about feelings. We're talking about a status between us as humanity and God. But do you see Christmas gives a way back? I mean, that's one of the reasons why I absolutely love Christmas. It's not just for the mulled wine and stuff. And I guess just, you know, right at the heart of the Christmas story, this may not actually be something you personally considered. In God's eyes, there's no neutrality. But he came to offer peace. Peace is actually on offer. It's a free gift. It is a free gift. That wasn't a mistake. But it does need to be accepted like any gift. And if that's something you want to hear more about, ask the person that brought you along today. And as I've already suggested, take away one of these, a biography of Jesus. Give it another hearing. Let's just close on our contrasting characters, Augustus and Jesus. In the end, Augustus, he does get a few monuments named after him. Apparently, in the Western world, about 250 known monuments, little statues or sort of mausoleums sort of thing an emperor does. 250 is pretty good in the Western world, isn't it? He also gets a month of the year, pretty good one. What about Jesus? What's his legacy? Well, Jesus has the whole of history built around him. His full biography, the Bible, it sold more copies than any other book ever. Every city in the Western world, increasingly every city in the whole world, has buildings like this, built for him. And his birthday. Well, that's the reason we're all here, isn't it? To celebrate his birthday. I mean, it not only divides our calendar in two, as is famously said, it divides our world of humanity in two. So why not give this offer of peace, free offer, give it a little bit more thought as you enter into Christmas this year. Let me close by wishing you a very, very happy Christmas.